I think we finished chapter 3 last week, which was the story of Elisha's advice to them down in Moab. Remember, the king of Israel decided to attack Moab and force them to again pay tribute. I was going to get my pointer so that I didn't have to get my hands all over the place that he couldn't see. They decided through Judah and Edom and come up through the south because Moab was highly fortified in the northern section, but not down here. And so he made an alliance with the king of Jerusalem and the king of Edom. And they came down and ran out of water, you remember, and they sent for Elisha. And Elisha said, make this valley full of ditches. And the next day, though there was no rain that they could see and no storm, yet up in the mountains of Edom there had been storms, and so the water rushed down and filled all of these ditches they had dug in the area here. And when the Moabites looked across as the sun was coming up, the water in all these trenches looked red to them, and they said, oh, these kings have slaughtered each other. Moab to the plunder. And so they rushed in thinking they could loot the camp of the Israelites, and the Israelites rose up and defeated them as God had said. Now, at that time, this, remember we said these were not in strictly chronological order. At the time of this story, Elijah is still living up in the area of Samaria. And so he sends Elisha down to be with the armies, and Elisha is the prophet who tells them to make the ditches, and God fills it with the water and gives them the victory over Moab. Well, from there, then in the next story, in chapter 4, Elisha is somewhere we don't know. It doesn't tell us exactly where he was, whether he went from there back up to Samaria, and it's in Samaria, but there is a school of the prophets, so it sounds like it could either be Gilgal, Jericho, or Bethel, where Elisha is in the story at chapter 4 of 2 Kings. And the wife from the company of the prophets, the wife of a man who had been, she's a widow now, cried out to Elisha, your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that he revered the Lord, but now his creditor is coming to take my two boys as his slaves. Now, that was the custom. If you couldn't pay your debt, you were sold into slavery till the debt was paid, or if the year of Jubilee came in the meantime, you were set free. But in any case, you were. Then if you were not available, if you had died, as in this case, then they would take your children and even your wife to pay the debt that you owed until the debt was paid. But remember, the Hebrew law of slavery was not a lifetime thing, not a perpetual thing, but every 7 years, you had to set the slaves free. And so when this widow came to him because she didn't want her little boys taken away from her, Elisha replied to her, how can I help you? What do you have in your house? Here's that same question again. Moses, what do you have in your hand? Elisha, what do you have? A mantle. And Elisha, what do you have? A mantle. And here he says to the woman, what do you have? What has God given you that he can multiply? And what she had was just a little bit of oil. Makes you think again of the widow of Zarephath, of Corrie ten Boom and her sister in the German prison.
And so she tells him, I have just a little bit of oil. That's all I have. But you know, little is much when God is in it. And so Elisha said, go around and ask all your neighbors for empty jars. Now, I had thought of the jars of those days as those big 5-gallon jars like they were at the wedding feast. But the commentary last night said that the word here means something similar to our quart jars or maybe a gallon jar, but a flask, something smaller than what I had envisioned. And so he said, don't ask for just a few. Ask for as many as you can get. Go around and get them from everybody you possibly can. Then when you've gathered all these jars, go into your house and shut the door. This is a private matter between you and the Lord. And take your sons with you and pour your oil, the little bit of oil that you have, pour it into all these jars. Well, now that's going to take faith on her part. It took faith on Elisha's part to believe that God could do this. But he remembered, you see, the story of Elijah and the widow of Zarephath. And he knew how God had provided food for the Israelites in the wilderness, water out of the rock, manna every morning, the quail flying over. And he knew that God was able to do this. Now, remember, as you think of this, God has promised you as his child, if you're a believer in the Lord Jesus, God has promised you, my God shall supply all your need according to his riches and glory by Christ Jesus. Ask and it shall be given you. God says. And he's the one who doesn't lie. He's promised to provide for you and your children. So he says, pour the oil into the jars. So she left him and afterward shut the door behind her and her sons. They brought the jars to her that she sent the little boys out to collect them all, just like Jochebed had used Miriam and Aaron to help her pull the reeds from the riverbank to make the little ark for baby Moses. And it's good to get your children involved in these things. One of the things I loved about the book La Brie and the things that Edith Schaefer writes is how they got the children involved. When there was a need, the children were asked to pray with them. It was a family affair. They all prayed together for the need. And then the children helped in the work. They brought other children. And it's interesting. I think it's wonderful when Edna Berge tells us about Ron and Fran over in Marseille, France, that their little girls are gathering in the children they play with during the week for the Sunday school. And Edna said last week that the Lord is blessing the work, so they've every time they meet, they have to bring in extra chairs, that there are more people coming than they really have room for. And that's wonderful, and that's a real blessing of the Lord when you get the children involved in, and then they see what it does to their faith, to increase their faith in the Lord and their dependence on him. So the boys gathered the jars from as many, and it says they brought the jars to her, and she kept pouring the oil and filling all these jars from the little bit that she had at the beginning. And when all the jars were full, she said, bring me another one. And they said, there aren't any more. We've got all that we could possibly get. So then she went to Elisha and told him they had done what he said. They had obeyed. They believed and they obeyed. And so he said to her, go and sell the oil and pay your debt. And then what's left over, you live off the rest of it. So that not only were their current needs met, their past needs, their current needs, but even the future was met. The Lord was taking care of them for days ahead so they could get ahead and keep paying their bills and keep meeting their needs. Are there any questions on that? These things are very relevant. They are miracles, but they are just proofs of the loving attention, concern of a heavenly Father for his children.
I have alongside of my verse there, the Lord fills, he keeps, he satisfies.
Amen. The Lord fills, he keeps, and he satisfies. Yes.
I understand you say that Elijah was looking in the south there at the same time that Elijah was?
Yes.
Then this miracle was performed. Elijah was still living.
I don't believe he was at this time, because it isn't in chronological order. The one down in Moab, he was still living. And even that, you see, is out of place, because we've already had his death.
Yeah.
So they've gone back a ways to give you a story of Elisha doing something during the time. And apparently it was when Elijah was older and maybe not able to travel that great distance.
And
they were both
at the same time.
That's right. Now, at that time, I would say Elisha was under the authority of Elijah. He was still his servant. But just as Jesus sent the disciples out before he left them.
So, he gets the impression that Elijah died.
Yes, I think they did. I think they were both teaching in these schools of the prophets and serving the Lord at the same time. But at that time, Elijah would have had superiority over Elisha. But now in this story of the widow's oil, I think now we've gone ahead again. And so now, wherever Elisha was when this happened, had to do with one of the men of the schools of the prophets. Doesn't have to mean that he was in the school of the prophets when this happened, but he had been. If it was in connection with one of the schools, it would have either been Gilgal, Jericho, or Bethel. Are the only places that are mentioned where there were schools. They may have had them in other places, or he may have graduated and lived anywhere in the northern kingdom here. But now in the next story we have, Elisha leaves this area of Israel and goes up, it's still Israel, but he goes way north to Shunem. Now Shunem is in this Jezreel Valley, which we also call the Valley of Megiddo, or the Plain of Esdraelon, the Plain of Jezreel. This big empty plain where the Battle of Armageddon is going to be fought. But Shunem is at the foot of one of the hills that surrounds this valley. We weren't there, but as the bus went along this area, we looked across and the teacher said, that's Shunem over, that little village over there is Shunem, where the widow woman Shunammite woman comes from. And incidentally also would be where the Shunammite in the Song of Solomon comes from. She was called the Shunammite. Now, he goes up here and there's a wealthy woman. In the King James it says a great woman, but that in the Hebrew means a wealthy woman. She and her husband had money. It was a well-to-do woman was there who urged him to stay for a meal. As he was passing by her home, she saw him, and she was a hospitable person, and so she invited him in to eat. So whenever he came by after that, and this apparently happened many times, whenever he went that way, he went in to eat with her. And she said to her husband, I know that this man who often comes our way is a holy man of God. Now, this is the first time that a prophet is called holy. And in the Old Testament, I think it said it was the only time that anybody was designated. But she recognized him as a man set apart for God's purposes, for God's work. And so she said, let's build a house, a room on the house, on the roof, but not just a shelter. Let's put walls and a roof. It'd be a real room that would be protected from the weather. Let's make a small room on the house, on the roof, and put a bed, a chair, and a table in it, and a lamp. Then he can stay there whenever he comes by, so that he could stay longer than just for a meal. But they had the money to do it, but you see the hospitality of someone who believes in the Lord. That's a characteristic. Remember, elders and deacons, pastors are supposed to be people given to hospitality. Hebrews tells us all of us are supposed to be given to hospitality, that even some have entertained angels unawares. And Jesus said, whatever you do to one of the least of these, my brethren, you do it to me. So that in a sense, you're even entertaining the Lord when you entertain members of his body. And he says here, the Lord's command to us is to be hospitable. And many people today, when they buy a house or build a house, if they're Christians and they have the wherewithal to do it, not all of us can do it, and God doesn't expect. Remember, he says, give as you are able, give as God gives to you. He doesn't expect you to give if you don't have it. And so she says, let's build this house. And many people will say, let's have an extra room that we can call, and they actually call it the prophet's chamber that came from this story that we're reading now. And many people do that today. One day when Elisha came, he went up to his room and lay down there, and he said to his servant Gehazi, as he's lying there on the bed resting, he's grateful. He's grateful for the shade, the comfort. Remember, I've said to you so many times, it wasn't easy to travel in those days. It wasn't easy to travel the days we went over in 78. And we had buses and modern transportation and good, thick, soled shoes that we had been told to get for walking. And we didn't have to walk everywhere. But everywhere that Elijah and Elisha went, they went on foot. And it's rugged country full of rocks. There's no place where it isn't rocky. And he was grateful for a place to lie down and rest. And so he's thanking the Lord, but then he's also grateful to the woman for her thoughtfulness and generosity. And so he says to his servant Gehazi, call this Shunammite. So he called her, and she stood before him. Now, the idea is that the etiquette of the day would, and that probably should be the etiquette of our day, but unfortunately isn't. But she could not go into the room where he was, into his bedroom. So she would stand outside, and Gehazi would be in the doorway, and she would talk to Gehazi, and they would talk through Gehazi, in other words, she and Elisha. And Elisha says to Gehazi, tell her you have gone to all this trouble for us. Now what can we do for you? Can we speak on your behalf to the king or the commander of the army? Can we ask for certain privileges or advantages for you to the king or the army for extra protection up here when they're getting up to the northern area closer to Syria? What can we do for you? And she gives the answer that we're told in the Bible should be our attitude at all times. She replied, I have a home among my own people. I'm satisfied. God has given me everything I need. I'm happy. I don't need anything else. A few years ago, my daughter-in-law took me to Verna Berkey's meeting up in Lancaster. I don't know how many. Have any of you been to the Verna Berkey meetings for women in this area? She comes every year or every other year. And she has seminars for women. And the little card she gave us at that meeting, and it's funny, it says at the very bottom, my big capital P in a circle is full. So whatever her theme was for that day, she was talking and it began with a P and I can't remember it for the life of me. But above it, it says, I choose to believe that God himself and what he has chosen to give me at this time is all that I need. And then down the bottom, my P is full. I don't know what that means, but it means I have everything I need, and that's all. And the New Testament says that godliness with contentment is great gain. The Old Testament says, thou shalt not covet. You should be satisfied because God knows best what is best for each of us. And so what he chooses to give us and what we have at this present time should make us thankful, happy, and content, and we shouldn't be craving other things which may not be good for us. And this woman was content. She was satisfied with God and what God had given her. And then when she leaves, Elisha says, what can we do for her? He still wants to do something to show his appreciation. And that's a good thing. There are often times when we take people for granted, and we should have more of an attitude of thankfulness and graciousness to those that do for us. And so he said, well, she doesn't have a son, and her husband is an old man. And he knew that the desire of every married woman's heart was for a child, and especially a son in those days, because everybody was looking for the Messiah and everybody hoped that her son would be the one that God had promised. And so Gehazi sees into the woman's heart there, which is an interesting touch about Gehazi, because we kind of are left with a bad impression of him in the next chapter. But then Elisha said, well, call her again. And so she came, and she stood in the doorway this time, right face to face with him. And Elisha speaks directly to her this time, not through Gehazi. He says, about this time next year, you will hold a son in your arms. Now, he not only promises a baby, but he says it's going to be a son. And this is such overwhelming news that it's hard to believe. And her answer shows that Gehazi had seen the truth. He saw down what she really wanted. Her heart longing was for a child. For a son. She says, no, my Lord, don't mislead your servant, O man of God. Don't play around with me. This goes too deep for that. Do you see what she's saying? But what he said came true. The woman became pregnant, and the next year, about that same time, she gave birth to a son, just as Elisha had told her. Now, this was a token to her that God was pleased with what she had done, and that this was a promise of blessing of the future care, because if her husband was old, he wasn't going to live too much longer. And widows had nobody to care for them. They didn't have retirement homes and nursing homes and things like Social Security and that sort of thing then. You were dependent on your children to take care of you. And so the child grew, and one day he went out to his father who was with the reapers. My head, he said to his father. The supposition is he had a sunstroke from the heat of the day. And the father told his servant, carry him in to his mother. And after the servant had carried him to his mother, the boy sat on her lap until noon, and then he died. Must have been a terrible blow to her. And a test to her faith, like Abraham's test of faith in connection with Isaac. And so she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God. She puts him up there where the servants and the rest of the household won't see what's happened. because she's trusting God. It's a wonderful picture of her faith. She closes the door on him, leaves him there where nobody will see him, goes out to the field to her husband, and she says, please send me one of the servants and a donkey so I can go to the man of God. Now, the servant would protect her, and she would ride to the man of God. Now, she's in Shunem, and it doesn't say where Elisha is, but he's in the area somewhere, and she knows where he is. I think it says he was at Mount Carmel somewhere. But in which? 24, the 24th verse. 25. Can't find it. So she set out and came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. So she's going from here to somewhere over here. And you know on the map it looks like it's only a step, but it's a couple miles. And the Mount Carmel is a range that rises like out of the sea and comes down diagonally here. And so somewhere along there she would know. Maybe it was at the place in Mount Carmel where Elijah had called fire down from heaven. But at any rate, she travels over to the man of God. But first her husband says to her, and gives you the impression when he says it, why do you want to go to him now? That it's a frequent thing with her to consult him about something or to take him something on at the holiday seasons and so on. And why to go to him today? It's not the new moon or the Sabbath. And she says, it's all right. Now, one of the ladies, we got ahead of you on the Wednesday class last week, and one of the ladies got upset about this. What did she mean saying it was all right when her son was dead? But you see, the woman had faith. God had given this to her as a proof of his love and concern, and she didn't believe that God would take him away. And so she says, it's all right, because whatever God does is all right. So she saddled the donkey and said to her servant, lead on, don't slow down for me unless I tell you. So she set out and came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. And when he saw her in the distance, the man of God said to his servant Gehazi, look, there's the Shunammite. Run to meet her and ask her, are you all right? Is your husband all right? Is your child all right? That's the way you greet in the Orient. You ask first about how you are, then your husband, then your children, then your mother, then your father, and your aunt and uncle, and your ancestors, and you go on and on and on. And so he has all these questions. And her reply to Gehazi is, everything is all right. It's in the hands of the Lord. It's all right. When she reached the man of God at the mountain, she took hold of his feet, and Gehazi came over to push her away. And the man of God said, leave her alone. She's in bitter distress, but the Lord has not shown me what it is. And then she rebukes Elisha. She says, did I ask you for a son, my Lord? Didn't I tell you, don't raise my hopes? And Elisha said to Gehazi, tuck your cloak into your belt. And see, they wore the long robes. And so tuck it up so it doesn't get in your way and trip you, because you're going to run. And run. He said, take my staff in your hand and run. If you meet anyone, do not greet him, because it'll take half the day, you see, asking about all the relatives. Don't stop to say hello to anybody, and when they say hello to you, don't pay any attention. Keep going, because that will hinder you. And so then he said, when you get there, lay my staff on the boy's face. Now, he knew the staff was not a magic wand, that the staff couldn't do anything, but it was the implement that God used for him, and so he told him to lay it on the boy's face. But the child's mother said, as surely as the Lord lives and you live, I will not leave you. she doesn't have confidence in Gehazi that she has in Elisha. And so Elisha gets up and goes with her. And Gehazi went ahead and laid the staff on the boy's face, but there was no sound or response. So Gehazi went back to meet Elisha and told him the boy has not awakened. And when Elisha reached the house, there was the boy lying dead on the couch. He went in, shut the door on the two of them, and what's the first thing he does? Prays. Prays, because he knows that it's only God that can do what's necessary to do here. Only the Lord. He prays. Let's say our verses. We haven't been saying them, and we're going to forget them if we don't. The effectual prayer of a righteous man availeth much. Elijah was a man just like us. He prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and that rain for 3.5 years. He prayed, and the heavens gave rain, and the earth produced crops. I'm not sure we were perfectly accurate on that. And what did Jesus say? Men ought always to pray and not give up. All right? So the first thing he does is pray, and that's your answer. Lest you think that there was something in Elisha or something in what he did that produced the results. It was God who produced the results. And today, let's remember that. There's nothing wrong with going to the doctor, with taking his medicine or doing what he says, but the healing, whatever happens, is in God's hands. We need prayer. We should pray before we go. And while we're going, and as the doctor works and prescribes and the rest of it. Incidentally, my husband is convinced he doesn't need his operation, so he wrote a second letter to the doctor and told him he didn't. Well, his symptoms have disappeared, and that could be. There have been so many of you praying for him. That could be. The Lord took care of it. Or it could be that the treatment the doctor gave him the last time he was in the office relieved things for a time, and I don't know. But anyway, the Lord knows, and it's in his hands. So Elijah reached the house. There was the boy lying dead on his couch. He went in, shut the door on the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. Then he got on the bed and lay upon the boy, mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, hands to hands. As he stretched himself out upon him, the boy's body grew warm. Now, he may have known the story of Elijah and the widow of Zarephath's son, who did something very similar to this in the case when that boy died. But again, he's hoping that his body will warm the boy's body, but that would not bring him back from the dead, you see. God has to do that. And so Elisha turned away, walked back and forth, and then got on the bed and stretched himself out once more. The boy sneezed 7 times and opened his eyes. And when I read that, I couldn't wait to get to the commentary, find out why he sneezed 7 times and didn't even mention it. I don't know, except that 7 is supposed to be the number of completion, and this he was completely brought back to life, and the sneezing produced the breath and started the lungs. I don't know. But anyway, the boy, God answered the prayer. God raised him from the dead. And what we need to mention here again, as we did with the widow of Zarephath's son, he was raised from the dead, but it was not the type of resurrection that our Lord Jesus had at Easter. Jesus is the first begotten of the dead. The first one to come out of the tomb with a glorified body that would never die, would never get sick, tired, or anything again, you see. And so these people were just, the spirit was returned to the same body that it had just left, a mortal body that would then again someday die and perish. and then be raised at the final resurrection. Elisha summoned Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite. And he did. When she came, he said, take your son. She came in, fell at his feet, and bowed to the ground. Then she took her son and went out. Now, what she did was the equivalent of the words of the widow of Zarephath. Now I know that you are truly a man of God, and the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth, is what the widow of Zarephath said. This woman, by her actions, showed her gratitude, but showed her acknowledgement that Elijah was a prophet of God and that God had done this miracle. Are there any questions on this? Well, then we go to the next one. Elisha returned to Gilgal. So he's way up here in the north at Shunem, and he has to come down and cross the Jordan. He has to come down here and go down the road from where Bethel is approximately, down that steep cliff from the mountain area down to below sea level, and the road would come down by Jericho, and then he would go from there to Gilgal, which is not too far from Jericho in the Jordan Valley. And there was a famine in that region. And remember, there at Gilgal, there is the school of the prophets. We found that out in the story of Elijah. And there was a famine in that region. Now, famine was one of the covenantal curses, remember. When God made the covenant, he promised for obedience the blessings in every area of life. If they turned from God to idols, then there would come these curses, war, famine, drought, pestilence, wild beasts, that sort of thing. And so here is famine in that region. But there is this company of believers there. And so they're meeting, and he said to his servant, put on the large pot and cook some stew for these men. One of them went out into the fields. I know we always say if we have unexpected company, put an extra potato in the soup pot. You have a big crowd of people. Stew is a good dish to have because it spreads. Put on the large pot and cook some stew from these men. One of them went out into the fields to gather herbs and found a wild vine. He gathered some of its gourds and filled the fold of his cloak. When he returned, he cut them up into the pot of stew, though no one knew what they were. That's a very bad thing to do, to eat something and you don't know what it is. It's a good idea, especially mushrooms. Make sure you got the right kind. But it would pertain to other things too. And you see, speaking of November coming up and Thanksgiving, the story of Squanto and the pilgrims, one of the blessings of Squanto was he told them which of the plants and herbs and fruit and whatnot were good and what was poison, and protected them by showing them where the good food was and what to avoid. And so here they're foolish in putting into the pot something they don't understand. The stew was poured out for the men, but as they began to eat it, they cried out, O man of God, there's death in the pot. Now, whether it caused severe pain, what made them know that it was poisonous before they died, they couldn't eat it. So it doesn't sound like anybody actually died from it, but they certainly were made sick in some way. There was some indication that this was not good food. Elisha said, get some flour. He put it into the pot and said, serve it to the people to eat. And there was nothing harmful in the pot. Now, again, it's one of those miracles we don't understand. Nobody explained that to me in the commentary or in the notes here. It said, the note down here says, the flour itself did not make the stew edible. It was simply a means by which the Lord provided for those who were faithful to the covenant at a time when others suffered under the covenant curse. So God is providing for them, and God, who knows all things, may have known of some chemical reaction between the flour and this plant that would take away its poisonous effect. and harmful effect. So, but God did it again. It's God who does it, not Elisha. Any questions on that? Now, I think the lesson there, not only that God is concerned and protects his people, and here, if this famine was a curse because of the idolatry of the people, it was God taking care of his own in the midst of that, like he did in Egypt when the plagues fell on Egypt, but the people God at that time are protected from what happens to those who have the mark of the beast. And in the Gospels and in Acts, remember, Paul put his hand in the fire and the serpent came out, but he wasn't hurt by it. And the promise was that if they were doing the work of the Lord, God would protect them from that sort of thing. Now, not if you go deliberately out and stick your hand in a serpent's mouth just to prove that God can heal you. That's tempting God. That's sin, not faith. But if you're doing it and something happens, God often, not always, there's no guarantee, but God often protects his own from what's coming. And always in the end, God will protect his own from the effects of Satan. Now, again, a man came from Baal Shalisha. I'm not sure that that is on the map. If anybody sees it, call it out. A man came from Baal Shalisha, bringing the man of God 20 loaves of barley bread, baked from the first ripe grain, along with some heads of new grain. Apparently, Baal Shalisha is up in the northern regions, and so he's still way up in the north when this happens. And notice that they brought them to, these are the first fruits. This is bread baked from the grain that was the first fruits. Now, who was supposed to get that? The Lord was supposed to, and of course, God doesn't eat that kind of food, but it would go to the Levites and the priests. But what about the priests and Levites that are serving up in this northern area? Mary?
They're corrupted.
They're corrupted. They're serving the Lord at Bethel and up here at Dan.
We have Dan on there.
They don't have Dan, but this is Damascus up here. So Dan is up in this area somewhere over here. And up there and down here, they have the golden calves, and they're worshiping the Lord in disobedience to the second commandment through an idol, you see. And the people apparently recognize that these are not true prophets of the Lord. They are the false prophets that not only are serving the Lord wrong, but are condoning the Baal worship of the people, the idolatry of the people. And Elisha and the prophets that he has gathered around him in the schools of the prophets, they are the true prophets of the Lord, and as such are the special people, the kingdom of priests that Deuteronomy spoke about. Remember, Peter quotes that in his epistle, that we who believe in Jesus are priests unto God and our Father, that we're a peculiar people, we're his chosen treasure, his own possession, a kingdom of priests. And that these were the true Israelites who were entitled to what was due the priests. And so they brought the first fruits to Elisha and his prophets there, the men of the prophets.
Are you saying that the true priests were in Jerusalem? Weren't they in Jerusalem?
Well, there were some down there. There were true priests in Jerusalem, but this is the northern kingdom. See, there are two kingdoms, and Elisha and Elijah are prophets to the northern kingdom. And so they are bringing them to them, and Elisha says, give it to the people to eat. And the servant says, how can I set this before 100 people, 100 men? Now, we've said that there, we mentioned 50 in the caves. With Obadiah, we mentioned 50 of the prophets down in Jericho when Elijah went to heaven. But here they have 100 of them. And that's just the men, just like the 5,000 in the New Testament doesn't count the women and the children, just the men. And he says, how can I set 20 loaves of bread before 100 men? But Elijah answered, give it to the people to eat, for this is what the Lord says. They will eat and have some left over. Then he set it before them, and they ate and had some left over according to the word of the Lord. And that makes you think of the stories in the Gospels, the feeding of the 5,000, and then later the feeding of the 4,000. They had a small amount, but God multiplied it so that it was enough. And I'm sure that you've had experiences like that even today. We used to pray when the taking the children to school and the gas tank said E. All of a sudden you looked and it said E, and you had to go to Willow Grove from Elkins Park and then get back again. And you prayed and somehow or other you got there. Or you have not too much to eat and somebody comes in unexpectedly. And the Lord, somehow you have enough and everybody has plenty to eat. And it's all taken care of because God can, as we said before, much, little is much when God is in it. And so the Lord does supply. Remember what he says in 2 Corinthians 9:8. But my God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound unto every good work. So that if you turn over what you have to the Lord, it may not be much. It may be just a little bit of oil. It may be just 20 loaves of bread against 100 people. But God can multiply it, and he does. You know, he even does it sometimes with time. There's sometimes when I'm on my way to Doylestown and you get on a two-lane highway and a truck in front is going 25 miles an hour. You only have 10 minutes to get there to be on time. And I've often marveled, how did I get there on time? Because I didn't speed and I was held up and all these things, red lights everywhere. And yet I got there by 10 o'clock. And some of these things are mysterious, but God can take care of all of our needs. He's promised, he does it. He's true to his word, and we can look to him and trust him for all these things. Are there any questions, or anybody has a testimony to that effect that you'd like to share?